with an M. I'll have to look it up later. He's been up before. And it'll take, five spacewalks, they said. Two at a time will go out to service that thing. It'll bring up a lot of equipment. New cameras and all. And now I know I'm going to time this machine out. Back to you, Dick.
I listened to one of the news conferences where they talked about the fact that they're doing practicing right now in the zero gravity tank in the, Alabama, I think is where it's located. And that's where they simulate gravity in a great big tank where they make neutral buoyancy on everything. They're coming up with techniques for capturing the screws. Turns out that some of the subassemblies on some of the spacewalks that they're going to be replacing were never originally intended to be replaced. They held down with a whole bunch of individual screws with individual lock washers and flat washers. And you don't want those things flying around in space because they could gum up the works if they fly in front of a mirror or get inside some of the gears or whatever. So every time they take apart a screw, they better capture it. I remember in one of the Story Musgrove missions, he dropped a screw. He carefully watched it go all the way down to the cargo hold of the space shuttle. He had the person who was controlling the Canadian arm that his feet were attached to slowly lower him all the way down to the cargo hold, and he went and picked up that particular screw that he had dropped. And now they're going to be moving a whole lot of screws, and they've come up with a mechanism to capture them. And at first you say to yourself, okay, you just built some kind of a vacuum device to vacuum up the screws. When you're in the hard vacuum of space, your vacuum cleaner absolutely positively doesn't work. Your vacuum cleaner works by creating a partial vacuum. The air pressure on the outside of your vacuum cleaner forces air to rush into the tube of the vacuum cleaner, and your particles of dust get swept with that moving air, and they go sucked into the bag of the vacuum cleaner. When you're in the hard vacuum of space, that doesn't work. Ain't a vacuum cleaner. So I'm guessing it's some kind of a enclosing plastic container-like thing that goes around the structure, and there's probably some sweeping brushes inside or whatever that sweep the particles into the back of the container. It's a mechanical vacuum cleaner. It can't be an air-type vacuum cleaner because there ain't no air out there. So I wonder if you read about that one, Paul. WS2M, KTYW, the tech man.
Yeah, I heard 126 screws that were not designed to be taken apart. Over 100 screws. That's quite a bit. So they got their work cut out. But I'm just put out one piece of equipment. Now I don't think that was a wide field planetary camera. That's been changed out before. They're going to change that out again. Put a better one in. Put all new gyros up there. Brand new batteries. The thing's in bad shape right now, so something wasn't working. I think it was the infrared is completely gone. I think it was the spectrograph that they're going to change out with these 121 screws, if I'm not mistaken, Dick. I don't know. Yeah, I often thought of that. You see these vacuum cleaning commercials for the house, and this one's more powerful than this one, and that one's more powerful than that one. You know, you're only going to get the 14.7 pounds per square inch top, no matter how strong of a vacuum you create. One way of doing it would be to increase the air pressure in your house. Seal up your house as tight as you can. And, you know, maybe raise the pressure inside your house. Maybe you'll get a better vacuum cleaner, even with the one that you have at home. And, yeah, I guess they can't shoot a bunch of air around in the space and put the vacuum on. It's too rarefied. It would just dissipate too quick. So I guess they had to come up with some new gadget. I didn't see that in Dick, by the way. So thanks for that. Back to you. WS2.
In their practice sessions, they're in the process of solving all these problems right now. I guess you've got a point, though. Very small jets of air could direct the pods into the back of the quasi-vacuum cleaner. That's a possible approach. But with 126 screws, 126 lock washers, 126 flat washers being removed and the equivalent being reinstalled, well, I guarantee the new one has captured hardware on it. And if they had it all to do over again, they should have installed captured hardware on the original thing that screwed down. They never intended to repair it. Yes, it was intended for 15 years. It's on its 16th year of service. And just like the Spirit and Opportunity, they're way beyond the normal lifetime, but they're continuing to give real good data. I mean, here we are in the 14th or the 15th year of Hubble when it made the best measurement it's ever made in its whole damn lifetime, the ultra-deep field measurement, with 2,600 galaxies in one particular picture that had never been seen before. That's a photograph with redshifts that are just out of sight. In other words, the amount of Doppler shift, because the object being observed is so far away, traveling away from us so darn fast, and accelerating in the velocity at which it accelerates away from us. So you got to quick take a picture of this stuff, otherwise in the next billion years it's going to be out of sight. There's a couple of puns intended there, but a degree of truth in it also. And you probably heard that only a couple percent of all of the mass, of all the stuff in this universe, only a couple of percent of it is observable, is giving off light, and you can take a picture of it. The rest of it is dark matter and dark energy, which does not show up in any of these photographs. It's indirectly being sensed there because you can tell there's some very heavy gravity objects distributed throughout the diameter of each of those galaxies. That's the only possible way they could have those particular velocities of circumferential velocities, to have that particular velocity profile of speed versus distance from the center of the galaxy. There's a lot of hidden mass in each one of those galaxies. And there's a multiple black hole, huge ultra-black hole. You're talking about a million solar mass type black hole is in the center of every one of these galaxies, holding just the center together. So, a lot more to be discovered, and you got to look at all of these wavelengths to figure out what's going on. You want to know what's happening in the far infrared, near infrared, low optical, middle optical, high optical, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, soft X-ray, hard X-ray, gamma ray, cosmic ray. Literally, DC... Literally, DC to gamma ray. DC to cosmic ray. That's further than DC to light. DC to gamma ray, or cosmic ray, you want to look at that whole spectrum to figure out what's going on, because every portion of that spectrum is telling you some other information about what the heck you're looking at. And you can do that as a function of wavelength, as a function of polarization, which is measuring local magnetic field, even though you're not there. The so-called CMOD effect. So, it ain't surprising that Murkowski, the local senator from that section of Maryland, finally got her way, got the funding, and she and some of her news conferences are saying, just tell us what you need, how many dollars you need. Right now, this whole Hubble repair mission is a couple of billion dollars, is one way of adding it up. However, you've already made the investment to build the shuttle. It's sitting there. Let's use it for this. And if you look at the total repair mission, it averages out to be something like $1 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. Are you willing to invest a dollar of your taxpayer money to give Hubble 10 times more sensitivity than it now has, to repair it so it's going to be operational for the next who knows how many years, a good fraction of a decade, and it's going to be able to make measurements on wavelengths that it cannot now make measurements on? Are you willing to invest a dollar in that? The average person who smokes a cigarette can burn that up in 1 hour. So from my point of view, it's an extremely good investment. Back to you, Mel. here we go, Paul. WS2N. What else is going on in space? Although Hubble is is number one right now. And I think you had a question about the fifth chart. You're allowed to ask it. K2LIW listening to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah. I'm thinking about the amount of pictures you did. They're up to like 700,000 pictures by the Hubble. So by the time they're done, I figure they'll be up to a million. So the total cost of the Hubble project, it's probably $20 billion or something over the years. Construction, servicing, 5 missions now, and each time they do it, it's $1 billion, right? So I think it was a $15 billion project. $1 billion in servicing missions. Comes out to $20 billion. A million pictures. So what's that? How much is that a picture thing? Oh my God. I think we got to keep it up to another 20 or 30 years to get it, to get our money's worth, to bring the cost down per picture thing. Yeah, I had one question for now on the chart. Very basic one. Back to you, Dick.
Go ahead with your chart question.
You still there, Mel? K2KEY, WS2N.
Roger, Paul. This is K2KEY. Oh, by the way, before I forget, you need a way to pick up screws or something like that in a place where you can't get your hand in. They have a thing called a pickup stick, which is basically a thin-like, pencil-like stick. And on the end of it, it's got some kind of sticky stuff. And I have one of them. It's amazing, for things that you can't pick up with a magnet or whatever. You just touch it with that, and it sticks to it all over.
Yeah, I like that. That sounds good. I haven't seen that one, Bill. But the one I like is the one, it's got like springs on the end of a screwdriver, and it grabs each one. That might be better for space. The sticky stuff, once it's floating, you're going to go and touch it with this. With that, it's gonna move right away. Unless it's really sticky. I was thinking maybe a net or something, some kind of a net where they can put it around, but I don't know, you'd have to almost completely enclose it to do that. I don't know, I gotta see this invention Dick was talking about the Smith chart. Let me drop it. I doubled with you in the beginning, you said, any questions, and I keyed up too late. Way over my head, by the way. Way over. But you were saying to, in the beginning, to follow the resistive circle. Halfway through, you got to the part about the wavelength toward generator circle. I was able to follow that around to your 39 degrees, but I cannot find the resistive circle on here. I have all kinds of circles, but which one is it? No.
If you follow through 1.0, you see that black circle that goes all the way around down to 50? That big circle that comes right off 1.0 goes all the way around. It's usually highlighted in a little darker color. Do you see that, Paul?
Well, before Paul picks it up, the resistive line it really is. In other words, because Mel had you set the Smith chart up vertically, right down the center of the chart, from top to bottom, there is a single straight line going right through the center. The top of it represents 0 ohms. The bottom of it represents, at the bottom of the circle of the whole Smith chart, represents infinity. In the middle, it's marked 1.0, and because everything gets normalized, 1.0 usually represents 50 ohms. So that's a line of 50 ohms. And if you now look at right angles from the center, you'll see the sort of a circle that Mel is talking about, at right angles to that vertical line of all the possible resistors, at right angle from the center going to the left and to the right, you'll see a circle that's usually darkened, which is considered the 1.0 normalized circle, which traces all the way around down to the bottom. It's a half diameter circle, so to speak. So it's a full 360 degree circle. And many people call that the 50 ohm circle. Wonder if you're able to find that one now, Paul. Go ahead.
No problem, I got it. Very good. Yeah. Yeah. On my chart it says that one long line, they call the resistance component R divided by Z. Yeah, I was looking at that and I said, well, it didn't say anything about the circle, so I couldn't find it. I was thinking one of the outside rings, but that didn't say it. You described it there. I got it. I see the 1.0, and I can see that that is the only one that really makes a complete circle. Everything else stops short of it, kind of. Let me look at that. 1.0 definitely makes like a complete circle. The other ones, I don't know, more like a ellipse, you know. I guess they're not really circles, are they? Yeah, I guess they're circles too. How could that be? Well, I see the 1.0 circle, so you consider that the 50 ohm circle right there.
Yeah, that is a circle where when you're taking all of your components of the impedance that you're concerned with, whether it be what your antenna is doing or what you see at a particular position along your transmission line, you could have R equal 50 and J equal 2 or J equal 31. In either case, you're somewhere along that resistive circle. The resistive component is 50 or 1 when normalized, and as you go to the left, you've also got the other component that's either capacitive, or to the right, the other component that's inductive. Positive X means inductive, negative X means capacitive. All impedances are a open parentheses R, comma, X, close parentheses. So all impedances have a resistive component, that's the R component, and a reactive component. We call that the X component or the JX component. And so that's your total impedance. So that so-called 50 ohm circle mark is in that Mel is talking about is all the possible reactances that have a 50 ohm associated with them as the resistance component. Anybody got any questions on that? Give us your question. Give us your call letter and name right now, K2LAW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. So it sounds like if you wind up on that circle, by the time you're done with whatever you're doing, you're going to be very happy. Somewhere, any one of those points on that circle, you're shooting for that, right?
As intermediate step, yes. Most guys will do impedance matching in a number of steps where they take whatever their crazy impedance they're starting off with and do something to get onto the 50 ohm resistive circle. That means the resistive component is now 50 ohms or normalized to 1.0. And then they do something else in the next step to get rid of the reactive component, which now walks you along that circle either clockwise or counterclockwise until you end up in the center of the chart. The center of the chart is home plate. That's the desirable position. And most guys do multiple steps to get onto the 50 ohm resistive circle first, and then once on that circle, put in a series reactant to either walk to the left or to the right to get onto the center of the smith chart along that particular circle. You could do it the other way around, but there's a bunch of reasons why it's usually simpler to do it the way I do it first. Get rid of the make the resistance 50 ohms first, then get rid of the reactants. Some people have tried to get rid of the reactants and then change the resistance. That's usually a little bit more difficult. And Mel has been doing it so far with a impedance chart. Whenever you've got a dot on the circle on the whole Smith chart, like his A point, you could measure a straight line from there to the center, out the other side, measure how far you are from center to point A, go the same distance out the other side of center to point B, I could call it, you've now flipped on the Smith chart from impedance to the opposite, one over impedance. I keep forgetting the name of it. It's not susceptance, it's not conductance, it's admittance. Okay. One over impedance is called admittance. Once you're using the chart in an admittance manner, that tells you how to make shunt components. In other words, a shunt stub, a shunt inductor, a shunt capacitor. When you're using admittance, you're allowed to put things in shunt, and they become a simple sliding along some portion of the Smith chart. When you're using the Smith chart in an impedance manner, you have to put things in series. Okay? If you're doing things inside of coax, putting something in series usually is more difficult. If you're doing things in coax, doing something in shunt is a hell of a lot easier. A tape connector with a stub hanging on it, or a capacitor hanging on one of the arms of the T, that's a shunt component. That's a admittance phenomenon. It's an admittance phenomenon, and for mechanical reasons, it's easier to put things in shunt when you're working inside the coax. But once you're hanging inductors and capacitors out in air, whether you do it in shunt or in series, it doesn't matter too much. And I think Mel did it all in series, did it all with impedance, and didn't use admittance. Did I get that correct, Mel? K2KEY, K2LAW in the TechNet.
You come away next week. Yeah, basically, I try to keep it as simple as possible by showing you that actually, if you made, let's put it this way, if you took a piece of cellophane instead of drawing it directly on the chart, and you just plotted the original point A, and then went through that from 1.0, I think the confusion was, and you come right down where that circle that comes through 1.0, the normalized 50 ohms, and the circle that we drew through point A, where they intercept on the chart, if you draw a straight line through that, right through the edge, in other words, you did this on a piece of cellophane, and now you just took the whole thing with leaving the lines just the way they are on a piece of cellophane and just rotated it back onto, you like you say, the normalized line, and then read on the chart where the capacitance has now shifted. It has shifted, remember, the whole thing is turned, so it shifted to a point where it comes out to exact plot point will be 1.59. Right on that curve, you'll see it at 1.59, and that's the plot spot that you'll find. So that's capacitive, of course, because we're working on the negative, like you say, the left side, the capacitive side. And if you want to, like Dick said, you can draw through, but I didn't want to get into that about, you know, if you were going to do it mathematically on paper and all, you can take the other vector reading on the other side of the chart, you can calculate everything in very accurately, but I don't want to get into that pick. Over.
Okay. We're giving you a little bit of a hint of Mel's lesson number 3 that's coming up. And by the time you guys have been through all 10 of these lessons, he's going to be issuing a certificate. With that certificate, you can present it to your employer. You'll increase your salary. You've been to a qualified school in wireless engineering impedance matching techniques. We're only half kidding here. Many of the schools that teach Smith chart only do a mediocre job of it. There's a lot of ways of using a Smith chart. Good old Mr. Smith had a great graphic tool. And to do it mathematically, after you learn to do it graphically, makes a lot more sense. Whereas if somebody gives you a bunch of steps to follow with a sequence of equations, and you've got this algorithm that you're following, steps of using various mathematical equations on your handheld calculator, if you've got one that can handle complex mathematics, like an HP 28, an old-fashioned one, but does a beautiful job. You can follow the algorithm, and you don't really know what's happening. Whereas with the graphic technique, you can sort of get a little bit more of a feel for what's happening, and then the math will make more sense. When you learn it that way, you're no longer memorizing an equation. You're memorizing a technique, you're memorizing a concept, and all of a sudden, re-deriving the equation becomes fairly simple. Let me drop a second. There's a whole list of equations that I use every day in the work that I do with antenna engineering. My employer, my main client these days for my consulting business is always asking me to stuff a high-performance antenna in some tiny little volume he's left over on the left-hand corner of a package behind the battery alongside of the power supply. I'm exaggerating only a little bit. So he's got a tiny little bit of volume left over, and he wants a high-performance antenna running over a whole lot of frequency range to operate in that area. And so I'm doing all kinds of nasty impedance matching and resonating under fairly difficult conditions. And so I'm flipping back and forth between using Smith charts and equations, but because I kind of understand, having been through it a few times, what's required, I have memorized what is the area of an antenna. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Or I've memorized the gain of an antenna. Gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. But then I know that the air field is 2d squared over lambda. And if you know the diameter of the effective area of an antenna, and you know the wavelength because you know the frequency, you can calculate the near field, how far you must be away to make real, true antenna gain and pattern measurements. You must be as far enough away from the antenna that you're beyond the near field. If you're inside of the near field on an antenna and you make measurements, you'll get readings that are crazy. You have to be real smart to know what the hell the readings mean, but you get readings that are crazy. They don't follow the inverse square law. So how do you calculate the near field for an antenna when you don't know the diameter? But you can calculate the diameter knowing that it's a circle and you know the area. So now you're cascading formulas, so to speak, to get from gain toward near field for a fixed wavelength. And so because I know the individual steps, I can start combining the formulas and make it all into one simple formula that does it all in one step. Well, I'll go one step further beyond this. When you're doing an impedance matching phenomenon, where you're flipping between impedance and admittance, and then rotating through a certain circle on the chart because you've got a certain length of feed line, and then you're going to hang a inductive stub or a capacitive stub, which is made out of a piece of coax on a T-connector, you got multiple steps you go through to get there. If you're real smart with using matrix algebra, which is called linear algebra, you can take all those individual steps, take the mathematics of what they're doing, and combine them into one whole linear equation, which you can program into a good handheld calculator. You put in the raw data, which is already in the wrong units, and the machine does all the steps internally of converting the units and doing the two or three cascaded equations, and in a fraction of a second, on the screen, it flashes the right answer. Put in a 3-inch length of cable, put a short circuit on the end of it, at the T-connector, and do it 2 inches back from the antenna. I mean, that may be the answer. And so, there's a fair lot to learn here. The best way to learn it is the way Mel is teaching you, one step at a time. But when you get familiar enough with it, you can skip over the steps. Your mind did that when you learned Morse code. In the beginning, you had memorized that the letter B is da, dit, dit, dit. And so when you were first listening to Morse code, you listened to the sound, you heard da, dit, 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 and you figured out how many dashes and dots there were. Mentally, you went to a lookup table, you figured out that was a letter B, you figured out how you write a letter B, and you told your hand to write a letter B. and you're practicing and practicing and practicing, and somewhere around 8 words a minute, you heard the sound, your hand moves, and you say, who did that? The mind can skip through the various steps, and it jumped from the beginning to the end. Mathematically, you can do that when you get familiar enough with Smith charts, the equations, and linear algebra. You can write computer programs and algorithms that skip over the steps. You put in the raw data that's already in the wrong form, and out comes the answer. And you can save yourself a lot of time. So I've got a whole lot of these handy little routines built into my handheld calculator. And if I ever leave that thing home, or I leave it at the factory when I come home, I'm like the guy who's like Linus without his security blanket. I'm in a lot of trouble, because it gives me a whole lot of answers every day. And you guys are slowly learning this process, so to speak. K2LIW in the TechNet, we're listening to anybody who feels like giving us a set of call letters and a name.
WS2N for now with the Smith chart business.
You got it, Paul, go ahead.
Okay, now I'm going to read up on this because from what I see, you're way ahead of me. I know I was in trouble when you said break out the compass and the straight edge. But, you know, in my extra book I have, I'm looking through it now, they break it down, you know, section by section, which is what I really have to go through now. So if you're going to go ahead with course number 3 and 4, bye-bye. I'll listen, but very interesting, Mel. I give you a lot of credit for doing it because there's probably guys out there that, you know, are advanced enough to follow it, and then there's guys like me that are way at the beginning section of this type of a chapter. It's unbelievable. I remember going through this, and this was a nightmare. But very good, Mel. Thanks for the info on this. Back to you.
Don't be intimidated by this poem. Just because it's an unfamiliar process, and just because the first time it was introduced to you by a guy who had an article where he didn't explain it in as simple and straightforward a way as he could have, is giving you a little bit of trepidation, and therefore you feel a little bit uptight when you see this kind of jazz going on of drawing lines with a straight edge and a compass. A straight edge and a compass ain't that bad. My daughter is scared to death of mathematics because she had the world's worst math teacher that started teaching her algebra in high school. And you mention the word algebra and math today, and she starts gritting her teeth even before you go into the next sentence. It isn't because she hates math. She hates the way she was introduced to the subject. And the guy scared the hell out of her that if she didn't learn it, she's going to fail the course and not get out of school and be a failure for the rest of her life. I'm exaggerating a little bit. But she has math and anxiety because she was poorly introduced to the subject. You may have a little bit of anxiety about Smith chart because the first article you read on it didn't put it as clear as you could have. And you didn't have a guy sitting alongside saying, don't worry about the details, just do this, and you'll eventually understand it. So, just follow along. When Mel tells you to take out Smith chart number 2 and 3, and you go to the right website, you can get them printed onto your printer, your laser jet or your inkjet printer, free of charge, in colors if you like. And so print out a bunch of them, or print out one good one and go to the library and get a bunch of Xerox copies, or lay cellophane over top so you can use them over and over again. Do whatever you like, with grease pencils or with salt tip pens, doesn't matter. But don't be afraid to use a ruler and a compass. And you follow the steps, and it'll start making some sense. And it won't at first. You're going to be frustrated at first. All new information, when you start learning it, is frustrating. And as the teachers in my college used to tell me, if you're frustrated, usually it's good. It means you're learning. If you ain't frustrated, it means you already knew it, you're comfortable with it, and you're wasting your time to be here. In general, when you're frustrated, it's good. K2KEY, it's about to frustrate us. K2LIW, you got to put them out.
Dick, you got to hear the first sentence of this book.
Go ahead, give us the first sentence to scale us.
Actually, they did pretty good. named after the inventor, Philip H. Smith. This chart was originally described in the January 1939 issues of Electronics. The Smith chart is an invaluable tool for calculating impedances along transmission lines and many types of matching networks for both antennas and other electronic circuitry. At first glance, it may seem formidable. They're not kidding. But the Smith chart is really nothing more than a specialized type of graph with curved rather than all straight lines. Yeah, okay. I mean, I'll get through this, but I like that formidable word. But then they show it. They break it down, the different lines. I see the prime center, the 1.0. They have that all broken down with the resistance circles. And then they have the reactance axis. They show that next. And a couple of other, lines. And they just get more and more detailed as it goes along. So it's pretty good. This comes out of the extra book from the ARRL. Back to you, Dick.
Now, let me show you something else. When you and I make an ordinary XY graph on a piece of quadrille paper, your X-axis is a whole bunch of horizontal lines, your Y-axis is a bunch of vertical lines, and every place where the horizontal lines and the vertical lines intersect, they're exactly at right angles to each other on that quadrille paper. Just like a piece of, screening on the window that keeps out the bugs. Well, there's something fancy about what happens with impedances on a transmission line where you want to use curves. You want to use circles and ellipses. You want to use curves. But take that piece of Smith chart that's in front of you. It's got a zillion places where the resistive line meet a reactance line. Notice that every single intersection along every one of those curves, of every one of those curved lines, every intersection is at right angles. I've actually seen the mathematics that Phil Smith went through to derive this chart. It's called a mapping program. He mapped from an XY into this curved domain, but he kept all of the lines of intersection exactly at right angles. Look at the left, lower left, the upper right, any corner of the chart you want to. All of the lines that hit each other always hit at exactly 90 degrees. Take a look at that, Paul, and tell me what you see. It takes a lot of magic to do that. WS2N, KQLIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I see it. When they combine the resistance circles and the reactance circles, I got this. Before they go further on, there's three sets of lines, the resistance circles and then the reactants. I'm not sure what the other ones are. But there's three different sets, and you can clearly see that each one is a 90. We have something called psychometric chart for pressure, temperature, humidity, and that was a similar kind of thing. So it wasn't, they had a bunch of curved lines when he was trying to track, figure out the humidity and pressures and temperatures and all. And that's what this is like. This guy designed quite a chart here. I see the 96.
Also, take any one of those curved lines you want to, and if you have a compass that's big enough, you can always find a place, quite often off the chart, but it doesn't matter. Lay the chart on a great big piece of fiberboard, we'll say, and tape it down. You can always find a place to put the point of the compass, and you can then find a place to put the pencil of the compass so that you trace out any one of those curved lines. Even those curved lines look real fancy. Believe it or not, every one of those lines on that chart is a pure circle. Many of those circles, you have to move the center of the circle or the diameter of the compass in order to trace them. But every one of them is a circle. There isn't one ellipse there. They look like ellipses. They're not. They're all circles. of various diameters and various center points. And yes, there are three sets. There's the resistive set, where the center of the circle is always somewhere along that horizontal line when you lay out the chart the normal way. Then there's the lower set of reactance circles, which are for capacitance. There's the upper set of reactance circles, which are for inductance. So there's three sets of circles. Almost all of the reactance circles, the center of those circles is off the chart. Whereas all of the resistance circles, the center of the circle is always on the chart. But everything there, nothing is an ellipse. Every one of them is a circle. And every single circle where a reactance hits a resistance, it always hits it at right angles. It's a lot of magic going on there. K2KEY, K2RIW in effect there.
Okay, you're right, Dick. Give you an A for this, this week's test. Yeah, it's, you know what it is, basically, here it is, Paul. All I'm trying to show you is something that will, if like hams, what are we mostly interested in? Get the antenna to match. Get that SWR down. And, yeah, if you take a look at a tuner, you just had a simple tuner where it has a capacitor in it, a variable condenser in it, and you had a rotary inductor. And you fooled around in a situation like this and went back and forth. You'd find, finally you'll find the match, you know, by diddling it back and forth and all. And you could then measure, actually you could measure the two components, measure the inductance with the right instrument and measure the capacitance, of course, with another instrument. And you could say, oh, this is what I need, I just want to copy this, basically, with fixed components. So all I'm doing is giving you something, an insight. In fact, once you visualize, you know, what's going on here, then like Dick says, you want to sit down and do it mathematically, you will get an answer, and you'll say, well, boy, this, you'll know right away, you say, gee, my answer is mathematically correct because I basically saw what, you know, what I was looking at here on a Smith chart. So I'm just trying to give you an idea that most hams are interested in doing matching. This is basically what it is. This is just another way of matching. Last week we just did something to confirm really that the antenna, you know, these antenna analyzers, handheld antenna analyzer, how accurate it is by basically putting it on a Smith chart, Paul, over.
The Smith chart does something else for you, though, Paul. It's a backup technique. Graphically, you may get it right. Mathematically, you can easily get it wrong. When you follow the multiple steps of the math process on a handheld calculator, if you skip one of the steps, or if you think you were about to put in a stub in series, but you put it in parallel, or vice versa, you can come up with a math answer that looks beautiful. Tells you to make the stub 3 inches long. The right answer may be the stub's got to be 13 inches long. When you follow it with a Smith chart, which is a slightly different procedure, you may very well find it. Whenever you're doing something a little bit elaborate like this, it's nice to have a backup independent technique for getting to the answer. If you do it as the charting technique, and if you do it as a math technique, and they both come up with the same answer to the nearest 5%, you can have some confidence in it. But there's a lot of ways you can use a computer algorithm where it becomes GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. You put in the data in the wrong units, the wrong frequency, it went in centimeters and you put it in inches, and stuff like that, and you come up with a beautiful looking answer, which is useless. It's nice to have more than one way of doing it and hope the answers come out right. And if they come out different, it tells you to start digging in and find out where the error is. WS2N, K2RIW in the
TechNet. Yeah, I can see that. Definitely a good backup. And then if you want to hit it on the money, and you try to get math and see if you're in the ballpark, I agree. By the way, Dick, I had something in here that you said before. The reciprocals of impedance, reactance, and resistance are given special terms. Names, admittance, and then they call it, well, in this book they call it Y, susceptance, B, conductance, G. They go on and on. You were talking about that before, the reciprocal. They do have that admittance in here. Okay, we'll brief through this there, Dick. Very good. Good there. Good net. By the way, I did download that chart that Mel recommended from the internet. That's what I've been using. I've had that here for the last couple of weeks since we started this. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah. One over impedance is called admittance. Impedance you normally measure in ohms. I've got ohms of resistive component and ohms of reactive component. When you're doing things in shunt instead of in series, you use admittance. The math works out easier. Admittance is one over ohm, which they just take the word ohm and spell it backwards, and they call it mo. So, admittance consists of a resistive component, which is called conductance, measured in mohs, or millimohs, or micromohs, and the reactive component of admittance is called susceptance, measured in mohs, or millimohs, or micromohs. And by the way, when you looked at, in the old days, a tube chart, and they talked to you about the gain factor of a tube, it was measured in micromohs. And the reason for that is because the tube was a nearly constant current generator. You change the voltage on the grid, and the amount of current that the plate would draw would change accordingly. The relationship between the two, a voltage change on the grid versus a current change on the plate, is a gain factor, which is measured in mohs, one over ohms, because it's a conductance going on. A constant current generator is considered a conductance generator. So some of this all relates back to tube theory. But when it comes to impedance matching, we're even building shunt networks or series networks or ladder networks, which alternate back and forth between shunt and impedance. Some of the impedance matching I've been forced to do has got some series elements and some shunt elements. And you look at that and you say, how the hell am I going to write an equation for that? And the answer is very similar to, let me drop. If somebody asks you, how do I eat a cooked elephant? And the answer is one piece at a time. You start at the tail. Or maybe you start at the foot. One piece at a time. So you first go through the series element and you add up the impedances. Then you flip that impedance on the Smith chart, going through the center, into a admittance, and then you go to the next shunt element, and you add the shunt. And you flip back again to impedance, and add the next impedance element. That's if you've got a ladder network, where you've got a bunch of things in series and a bunch of things in shunt. You flip back and forth, and you work your way back from the antenna toward the signal generator, one step at a time, flipping back and forth and adding. You try to write an equation for the whole great big network of shunt things and series things, it'll drive you up a wall, and your chances of getting it right are very slim. You make one mistake in the beginning of writing that equation, and you carry it through for the next 15 steps, and you can get into a lot of trouble. But one step at a time, but adding a shunt and adding a series and so on, it becomes handleable, and you can see whether or not you're going in the right direction. And it can be done in math, or it can be done on plotting a piece of paper. Each has its advantage. The chart is a lot more visual, but it gives you a little bit more error. But the error it gives you, for most of our homework, is way good enough. You carefully use that chart, and I think you can keep the accuracy within 5% on two or three steps of the process. The good news about the handheld calculator, in the case of my HP28, in theory, I can get 12 decimal places of accuracy out of it. I say in theory because the raw data I went in with, I mean, on the front end of that capacitor, it says 1.5 picofarad. But you dig a little deeper, it says plus or minus 10%. So to have 12 decimal places of accuracy in the calculator, when I have only one or two decimal places of accuracy in the raw data I'm putting into it, at times that can get a little silly. which is the best way to go? Depends on you. Learn them both. Anybody with any further questions? K2RIWTechNet. About to put everybody to sleep.
Yeah, one more thing, Dick.
Go ahead, Mel.
When you mentioned about how they teach school mathematics, I had that with my daughters. They were so fed up, you know, they didn't know if they're coming and going. I used to sit at night with them and go over it step by step and explain it, break it down, and then they'd say, oh, I get it now. The teachers do not know how to teach in most cases. There's the problem. They'll throw a bunch of things at these kids, and no wonder that they can't comprehend. I see it why it's just not. You know what it is? Unless you had experience for some real reason in any field like we are, you can't get it over to somebody by just trying to, you know, sit them down there and saying to them, well, I know it's so good. You know, you'll throw it at them real quick. You really got to give them a step-by-step toolage, Dick, and this is basically. Oh, I also got an email, a very interesting question from a science teacher, electronic instructor over.
Yeah, this should be good. Go ahead.
Okay. The ampere is a unit of current and is commonly thought of as of quantity, but actually it is a rate of quantity of per unit of time. In hydraulics, its equivalent would be gallons per unit of time or liters per unit of time. Now, what is the electrical equivalent of these gallons or liters? What is the electrical equivalent of gallons or liters of time, Dick? Do you know?
I think I do. One of the definitions I've seen for 1 ampere is 1 coulomb worth of electrons flowing through 1 point in 1 second. 1 coulomb's worth of electrons, which I think is 1.9... 10 to the 19 power, I think it is, of electrons, but a coulomb's worth of electrons, which is a certain amount of charge. So it's really a certain number of electrons per second flowing through a particular point is 1 ampere. And I think it's 10 to the 19 electrons per second with a factor in front of it. Back to you, Mel.
Can't give you 100 on that. You're right, it's a coulomb. I had to look it up, so I don't get 100 either. I thought of Coulomb right away, but it's 6.25 times 10 to the 18th, Dick, over.
Okay. I was off by an order of magnitude. I thought it was 10 to the 19. 1.9, 10 to the minus 19, I think it is the amount of charge per single electron in Coulombs. I think a coulomb is approximately 1 cloud's worth of electrons, 1 good rain cloud's worth of electrons. And so it's a certain number of electrons per second. And even though those electrons, the effect of them moves at the speed of light, the real rate of movement is very, very slow, each individual electron. Remember that example I gave of on a cold morning, you turn the key in your car, and that battery is shoving as much as 400 amperes for the first second into that starter motor, in the case of a 6-volt car. 400 amperes is flowing. That's an amount of current that's huge by your and my standards. And you watch that red electron come out of your battery, out of the negative lead, and go toward your starter motor. And that one single electron jumps into the wire, and a few nanoseconds later, another electron jumps out of the wire into the starter motor. That effect only takes nanoseconds. 3 feet would be 3 nanoseconds. But you watch that one electron, red one, go into the wire. He takes 4 hours, on average, to come out the other end. The total amount of charge in that piece of copper is huge. Mother Nature won't let you drain that charge out of that piece of copper. But if you could, if she would let you drain all those electrons out of that piece of copper wire between your battery and the starter motor, if she would let you do it, you could get 400 amperes out of there for 4 solid hours. If you were allowed to drain all the electrons out of that piece of copper wire. To me, that's amazing. Back to you, Mel.
Well, this is the future of so-called superconducting and all this kind of jazz, you know, these batteries that they're promising for the future that will be able to drive around all day long and then go into, instead of a gas station having a type of, you know, thing delivering a fluid into our tank, it'll give it one shot, some kind of charge, and off we go again. I tell you the truth, I guess that's getting into a whole other situation of where eventually we'll go, you know, the science of energy. But it is a very interesting concept, but you just brought up, Dick. And I guess with our dream of getting this infinite amount of energy is it's just going to be somewhat, I'm sure someday it will be commonplace in the future. I know people, my, I guess our grandchildren, will stand in the street and one day say, oh boy, look at that. I think that was a gas-driven automobile that just went by an antique. Because most likely by that time they'll have the hybrid will move into some other kind of super type of energy-driven type of automobile. Dick, over.
Oh yeah, batteries are coming a long way. Way back in the old days, we used to have the LaCroche battery, the carbon zinc battery, the so-called dry cell. We thought that was pretty good. But until we came along with some electrical rechargeable batteries like lead-acid cells, they were very good. Not quite as convenient, though, because of all the darn liquid in them compared to a nickel-cadmium. Nickel-cadmium you could recharge maybe 500 times, but it doesn't have a great number of ampere hours in it. And come metal liquid, here we go, metal hydride, you know the one I'm trying to say. Nickel metal hydride, a little bit better. Nowadays we're using lithium ion batteries and lithium polymer batteries, much higher in energy density. But the fact that that chunk of copper has that many amperes packed into it tells you that once we get smarter and smarter with batteries, we're going to get more and more energy in smaller and smaller packages. Lithium polymer right now is about the most popular high-density battery for portable operated equipment. But that's not the end of the line. People are trying real hard to get fancier rechargeable batteries with higher energy density than that. You want more watts per pound and more watts per cubic centimeter out of that battery, more joules of stored electrons, stored energy, joules of watt seconds. Now when it comes to teaching, very few teachers have the skill of empathy to know the way the average student in the class thinks and is able to put what they're teaching into the vocabulary that the majority of the students can absorb. That skill of empathy does not come by simple book learning. It has to have a certain amount of charisma of the student, of the teacher, a certain pretty high IQ of the teacher. He has to have a considerable amount of experience in the field of the technology he's teaching, as well as the field of the educational process and how people remember things. The bottom line of all that is you want a smart guy who's been to a good school, who's got the right raw machinery between his ears in order to make a good teacher, and a guy who's dedicated to the profession. A guy who's got all of that in one human being is a valuable person. If he goes to the right industry, he can get a lot of money. Why the hell would he want to become a teacher and get half the salary the industry will give him? Because we underpay our teachers, we quite often don't get the top of the line. Because we don't get good teachers, we don't get students as good as we could. Because the students are not as good as they could be, they in turn turn into teachers that are not as good as they could be. It's a vicious cycle. Looks like we're coming very close to the end of our rope, Mel. But you need good engineers if you want good engineering and good products. You need good teachers if you want people to understand it. and both of them are...